From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. American supporters of President Trump routinely echo his simplistic rhetorical flourishes against immigrants in the United States. They scream, "Build the wall," without bothering to understand what it is that drives migration from Central America and Mexico to the U.S., or what the human cost of that migration is. Now, a new book written by an American who spent time in Mexico and spoke to migrants heading north attempts to humanize the people who dream of a better life in the U.S. What they've experienced is harrowing and unlike anything most of us would ever experience. Kelsey Freeman is a writer and educator focusing on immigration policy, indigenous rights, social justice, and public policy. She received a Fulbright Fellowship to teach English and study migration in Central Mexico. She currently runs a college readiness program for Native American high school students. And she joins me to discuss her new book, No Option But North, The Migrant World and the Perilous Path Across the Border. Welcome to the program, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me, Sonali. It's great to be here.
So first, give me a little bit more background on what took you to Central Mexico and what it was that you went there to do that ended up leading to you writing your book.
Yeah, so I think it really goes back to this moment I had in this conversation I had before I ever went back to study migration. So I was traveling in southern Mexico in Chiapas doing research for my undergraduate thesis, which focused on indigenous rights. And I was seeing how intertwined indigenous rights and immigration were in that research. And then one day I had this conversation with the man next to me on the bus. And he asked me straight out, he had been deported from the U.S. Years prior, and he asked me, how is it that you can come to my country and study my people for 2 weeks while I've been repeatedly denied for a visa to go back and visit my family in your country? And that, to me, cut to the heart of it. And I didn't have a good answer for him at the time, and it caused me to want to dive deeper into our immigration system and how it is that nationality and class and race plays a role in who gets to come to the U.S. and who doesn't.
So who were some of the people that you then met in Mexico? And give me a sense of the kinds of stories you started to collect. Some of them are quite difficult to hear.
Yeah, so then I went back on a Fulbright grant to study migration and teach English. And I was in central Mexico, right along the path that many migrants take north, because La Bestia, the freight train that many migrants rely on, goes through the city. So then I started interviewing migrants at the local migrant shelter. And the stories that came through the shelter were harrowing and were devastating in ways beyond what I had expected. I think what was so striking was the web of violence and all the risks that particularly Central American migrants are navigating as they journey through Mexico and across the border. So I spoke with, for instance, a man who had been kidnapped by Zetas, by one of the big cartels in Mexico, who had been held ransom for days on end while they waited for money from his family in the U.S., and then they eventually released him. I talked to, you know, dozens of migrants that had been beaten or had been held at gunpoint. I talked to migrants that had experienced sexual assault on the journey north, and migrants that had prepared for the very real possibility of sexual assault and rape on the journey north. So all these stories of violence and what people are willing to endure or do endure to get to the U.S., I think points to this really tragic truth, which is that there's a reason people take on these risks, and I think it's that there's greater suffering at home.
So the cartels that you mentioned, the Zetas, which are one of several cartels in Mexico, what sort of role do they play in society there? Because the people that you talk to were from Central America, I think, many of them. So they were already immigrants in Mexico on their way to a third country. Are Central American migrants most vulnerable to cartels than other forces, than even the Mexican government?
Yeah, so I mean there's a couple roles that cartels play in this world of migration. There's the role they play for Mexicans in terms of threatening people's lives and destabilizing the essential pillars of the state within Mexico that causes, Mexicans to flee. But then there's also the role they play in targeting Central American migrants, and that's something I really got a lot of insight to in these stories, because cartels like the Zetas have made an industry, the side industry as well as transporting drugs out of kidnapping Central American migrants. And as you mentioned, Sonali, Central American migrants are very vulnerable the minute they cross into Mexico because they're technically in Mexico illegally. So the whole time they're trying to avoid authorities. And that causes them to take on these really, or to transit through these really remote routes, which renders them very vulnerable to cartel violence. And criminals that target migrants know that they aren't going to, be able to defend themselves. They know they're not going to be carrying arms, etc. They know that they're going to be carrying all their cash on them. And they know that they're not gonna denounce the abuses they face because there's not really a viable avenue to investigate those types of crimes in Mexico.
When we hear American responses to this migration northward, the ignorant responses in particular often include, why can't you just come to this country legally? Get in line. Where's the line? What sort of line are we talking about?
Well, the thing is, that's something we hear a lot. And the thing is, there is not a line for the vast majority of working class migrants that I spoke to that were fleeing by necessity. So, really, there are only four main ways to come to the US legally, four lines to get in, so to speak. And that is you can be sponsored by your employer through an employment visa, but that's typically for more highly skilled workers. You can be sponsored by family if you have a direct family member that's a US citizen. You can apply for political asylum based on the grounds that you're fleeing persecution in your home country, but that's a very strict legal definition, that can be hard to win those cases. And there's a diversity visa lottery, which is 50,000 annual visas, for, the whole world. For immigrants that tend to, or countries that tend to send less immigrants to the US, so that excludes countries like Mexico. And that's it. So if you're like the vast majority of the people I spoke to who, say are fleeing gang violence and your life is threatened in your home country, you can't, you say you're from Honduras and you can't go to Mexico because of the transnational nature of many of these gangs, they'll still be able to find you often. And so the US seems like the only alternative for safety, yet you go and you make your case for political asylum because you're fleeing for your life, but because it oftentimes doesn't fit into that strict legal definition, over 8 out of 10 Central American and Mexican migrants lose their asylum cases. So what do you do if you lose your asylum case? Well, there's no line, there's no other recourse. So many of those people will attempt again, right? Rather than, die in their home country, they'll cross, without papers or illegally.
In your book, you describe how the motivation to come to the United States is steeped in desires for a safe future for children. You also met children and encountered the stories of children. Tell me a little bit about the trauma that children face from remaining in their home countries and even through or during the journey that they make northward with their parents, and I believe in some cases without, of course.
Yeah, so this is something that I think we don't recognize often in the US too, is just the amount of trauma that one carries from this journey north. Again, we're talking about risking kidnapping, being held at gunpoint often, taking a freight train that's moving and that was never meant for passengers. So yes, I met kids along the way. I in particular spent the most time with this family that was a mother who was 8 months pregnant, her husband and her 3 and 6 year old daughters. And to the parents had said, luckily nothing that bad has happened to us thus far, but they still were walking hundreds of miles across Mexico through remote regions, still catching a train that's moving. And so if you imagine kind of the weight and the uncertainty that I think children in particular internalize, it weighs on you. And then to think about those that are unaccompanied minors traveling alone only to get to the US and be detained often in these really horrible conditions often and then face the legal system often without a lawyer representation. There's a lot of trauma there that we don't often recognize.
You said that there were some migrants you spoke to who had essentially accepted the fact that they might be sexually assaulted.
Yes, and this is something that there's been a fair amount of research on, in that women often, and I spoke to women that take birth control pills in preparation for the journey north. And that to me is tragic and points to that fact that women are literally preparing for the very real possibility of experiencing that kind of life-altering trauma. So again, if you're preparing and taking on that risk of being sexually assaulted, there's greater suffering at home. There's a reason that people are fleeing.
The cartels, going back to how they have preyed on migrants heading northward, you mentioned it's essentially they've created a whole new industry now of kidnapping and ransom. So the drug trafficking is one aspect of it, and then simply the kidnapping and ransoming of migrants heading north. How serious an issue is this? And, is this basically something that migrants are also taking for granted that they have to go through in order to reach the US?
Yes, it is increasingly becoming something that migrants accept as a reality or hope that it doesn't happen to them. But it's a very common issue, unfortunately. There's many stories of mass kidnappings, 72 or upwards migrants kidnapped at once, oftentimes off of the freight train or places where migrants are transiting, again in remote regions often. So yeah, these mass kidnappings where then people are held in houses and held for ransom until their family in the US pays, $400 or $500. And it seems odd because why would you kidnap or why would you target migrants who are, some of the most vulnerable people out there? But the reason is exactly that. Cartels take advantage of their vulnerability because if you can, mass kidnap 100 migrants and scare them and their families into paying $500 a head, and Mexican authorities turn the other way or even, assist in some situations, then it becomes a side industry. And it again points to the fact that migrants are in such a politically precarious position, where what is their recourse then? I mentioned a story in the book where a woman escaped being kidnapped, went to the police, and the police were working with the local cartel, and they brought her back to the cartel to be held ransom again. And so, yeah, it's really, again, it's a web of violence that migrants know about and navigate And because they lack other options, this is what they take on.
The drug cartels in Mexico have become fodder for television shows here in the United States. They become these useful villains in popular TV shows and movies. What do Americans miss when they view what's happening in Mexico through this lens? Is this just a convenient foil or just this one-sided view of what's taking place?
I think it's really easy when you watch those TV shows and that's all you know, is a couple of things. First of all, to romanticize or kind of or sensationalize the violence that people endure, and to make it this kind of thing for entertainment as opposed to a very real reality that people face. So there's that danger. There's also the danger of people extrapolating that narrative out to all of Mexico. And, I have people ask me all the time, well, isn't it so unsafe to be alone and traveling in Mexico? And the answer is that, you have to hold nuance here. You have to hold multiple realities at play because there are areas where, yes, cartels and organized crime have eroded the state and everyday citizens are at risk. But there are other areas in Mexico that are completely safe right now and haven't had that same kind of violence. So you have to be able to hold both. And what those shows often do is they take away any kind of nuance to the situation. And then they also, like I said, romanticize or make violence as a source of entertainment as opposed to a reality.
You have a section near the end of your book on gender, whiteness, and privilege. And this is a thread throughout your book as well, where you attempt to identify how your privilege has opened so many doors. And we started our conversation saying that migration southward is, especially white Americans, is something that you can take for granted, but northward is completely opposite. There's this huge controversy in recent months over a book, fiction book written by a white American woman. Well, I think she has some Puerto Rican descent, Jeanine Cummins, the book American Dirt, that generated controversy about who gets to tell the stories of people who live south of the border. How did you navigate the fact that your gender, your race, and your nationality privileges you to tell these stories?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I am so, I feel happy that these conversations are occurring, and I think it's really important, especially, in the ways that people all around the country have been talking about this with American Dirt. And I think for me, for navigating what my role is in telling these stories as a white person, as a white woman, as someone from the US, a couple of things. First of all, I think in my experiences and conversations with migrants, it was important to not pretend that the power dynamics didn't exist, but rather to name them and to call out their injustices, right? And so I had those conversations with migrants about the fact that it's not fair that I can just cross the border so easily without any kind of process or bureaucratic hurdles. And so that was important for me. I think also in terms of the question of who gets to tell these stories, I think in my approach, what felt important to me is not to tell stories in this goal of giving voice to the voiceless or humanizing a faceless brown mass, as the introduction of American Dirt says. That's not my goal. My goal is rather to give voice to the structural injustices and inadequacies that then render these stories possible in the first place. So I do tell stories, I do in I think that's an essential part of the book, but my goal is always to connect that back to what are the policies and practices that make people put people in these situations in the first place, which I think is an important role as if we're trying to think about allyship in a productive way, I think our role more is to focus on the political rather than trying to sensationalize violence or tell people stories for them or humanize, give voice to the voiceless, all these different things that I feel like are not productive as white people. And so those are the approaches I've been thinking about.
In your conversations with some of the migrants heading north, who, as your book title suggests, feel they have no option but to go north, what did they think was in store for them in the United States? What was their view of what lay here? Because the reality under President Trump's regime in particular is potential detention, potential separation from your family.
Yeah, so I think especially when I was there, in 2016 and then 2017, people did not have this rosy-colored American dream kind of version of the United States that sometimes I think we often tell. Rather, it was more this idea of this is a better option in a place where my alternate options for survival and decency have run out. So people were not naive about the fact that they knew their labor would be exploited, for instance, and that you'd be working jobs, far below the minimum wage without protections and for more hours. And then they also were, hearing all the xenophobia and racist discourse towards migrants coming from, the election and the Trump administration. And, I think people were fearful. There, I had a lot of conversations with migrants before I interviewed, kind of sifting through different policies, because there was a lot of fear among migrants about what can change, what's gonna change, what policies won't change. And so sifting through that, I felt like was an important role that I could have, and helping dispel fears if I could, or sit with very real and valid fears. And
And of course,
so,
the rules have continually changed under Trump, and the between Trump and the courts, there have been policies that change overnight. We've had the Remain in Mexico policy now with the coronavirus pandemic. They stopped processing all applications. It's just depending upon when you are lucky or unlucky enough to arrive at the border, you might face a completely different set of circumstances. A set that these migrants, seem to still feel is worth it, given what lies in wait for them back home. Finally, Kelsey, do you hope that your book will be widely read here in the United States? Because it's Americans having this sort of information at their fingertips that can change the policies, at least from the U.S., that could ease life for migrants, right?
Yes, exactly. I hope that the role the book has is to connect the personal with the political. So to cause people to empathize, to see migrants as fully human, and cultivate respect for them as human beings. And then ultimately to begin to shift the narrative so that hopefully our policies can shift along with them to stop criminalizing migrants and see them, as fully dignified human beings.
Well, Kelsey, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with your book.
Thank you, Sonali. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Kelsey Freeman. She's a writer and educator focusing on immigration policy, indigenous rights, social justice, and public policy. We've been discussing her new book, No Option But North: The Migrant World and the Perilous Path Across the Border. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.